Thank you, Michael, for those kind words of introduction. I'm going to slightly adapt the title, which I didn't choose myself, because the phrase was in 21st century Britain. I think it really should be for 21st century Britain, bearing in mind we're talking about the collection, or I'll be talking largely about the collection of foreign intelligence. And I would go a bit further and say, you know, if one's talking to the letter of the law, it's really the larger question is what are the priorities for intelligence to support Britain's foreign and defence policy and its national security objectives. And I would also remind you, and although this isn't very fashionable, I want to say something about it, that if you go back to look at the Intelligence Services Act, it does also mention the protection or promotion of the United Kingdom's economic well-being. The first half of my talk is relatively conventional on the defence and foreign policy side. But the other two issues, national security objectives and economic well-being, I think begin to raise some important issues which are worth consideration and discussion. I've written recently a couple of articles on national security, and I think it is in the process of significant mutation. What actually now consists, you know, what does national security consist of? And in addition to that, I want to say something, because it could be topical, about economic well-being. Just let me just note here that when the Dutch government was changing its legislation to give its security service, the BVD, more capability to collect intelligence, it had originally in its draft legislation the phrase economic well-being. And if I remember correctly, the European Commission strongly objected to this. And I think as a consequence, the legislation was actually changed, I'm not sure. But I think it's worth reminding ourselves that that phrase is still in our legislation. Now, just some history and some facts before I get into contemporary areas. And apologies to the experts who know all this well, but I think it's important just to remind you. I mean, let's start off with the principle that intelligence services in democracies should never task themselves. This isn't entirely true, of course, of security services, which perhaps need a measure of independence in judging what the threats are to national security. But here in the UK, the priorities for intelligence collection are set by the JIC, by the Joint Intelligence Committee, i.e. customer departments express their intelligence wishes, as it were, and these are agreed by the JIC and eventually approved by ministers. And you end up with a series of priorities organised. That will sound great on the, on the recording. You end up with a series of priorities which are ordered, or used to be ordered. I'm not sure whether the same system is still used, but I'm sure the theory is still there. However, the allocation of resources by the intelligence community is usually an issue for the professionals, i.e. how hard it is to collect intelligence against a particular requirement and how much resources you should expend against the particular target. And the services generally have to defend their resource allocation to the Treasury, to the ISC, and ultimately to ministers. But those resource allocations are not, as it were, dictated to the services. Now, I think you should all bear carefully in mind that British intelligence is a pretty small outfit, generally speaking. And because of the tradition of the United Kingdom's complex overseas engagements, it's generally speaking asked to do an awful lot with small resources. And a good example of that is the small amount of resources devoted to Iraq at the time that we start building up to the Iraq War. And that, of course, is brought out in a number of the five inquiries, I would remind you, that have now been held on the Iraq War. Even at the height of the Cold War, not much more than a third of the intelligence services resources were devoted to the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. And the reason I make that point is that, for example, in the post-colonial era, there were many foreign policy issues which required strong intelligence coverage and support for the policymakers. So the consequence of the UK punching above its weight internationally is frankly an implied dilution of intelligence resources. And I think it's also important to remind everybody that an awful lot of foreign policy issues or defence policy issues that perhaps do not require any use or any significant use of intelligence resources at all. And it's important to bear that in mind. Now, yes, 9/11 was, of course, a defining moment. It brought to an abrupt halt what I would have described as a period of post-Cold War drift on exactly what the UK's intelligence requirements should be. But it's worth remembering that the resources devoted to radical Islam and radical Islamist terrorism in particular had started to grow significantly before 9/11. So 9/11 is, you know, a dividing line. It's one of those lines probably in history, certainly in intelligence history, where there's a clear before and a clear after. And the effect of US decision-making in relation to the subject that I'm covering here, of course, has a massive impact in the UK. And you also get an accelerated growth across the intelligence community in the resources available. And the sequence of events unleashed by 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq, the Americans' global war on terror, the 2005 attacks in London, have of course a massive and distorting effect on the deployment of the UK's intelligence resources and on the requirements. And I think it's worth making the point that counter-terrorism is extremely hungry of resources, particularly the resources that SIS would deploy, and the security service, for that matter. Human penetrations tend to be transient, short-term. You're not dealing with organizations that have secrets locked in safes or telephone directories or organizational charts. You're looking at something which some experts have described as, let's say, a flock of birds, which aggregates and disaggregates without apparent logic. There are many complicated, difficult liaison relationships with partners that politically are not reliable. There are many less experienced intelligence services that need to be mentored, that need to be helped in looking at this issue. I don't know what the level of resources now devoted to counter-terrorism is. I've heard figures as high as 70% or more. It certainly was nothing like that when I left the service, although it was climbing fast. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if that is now the case. So against this background, what should our priorities be? And just before I sort of plunge into that, can I just make one comment, which is really derived from my current experience, because I get involved in advising quite a lot of hedge funds and investment companies. And what's interesting at the moment, I think, is the sensitivity of financial markets, which I think operate more quickly in this respect than governments, to the whole question of geopolitical risk. And at the moment, geopolitical risk, sort of as an issue in the city, is making a huge comeback. There's a demand for expertise in this area. And I think it's worth saying that the reason for this, I believe, is because in 2011, we're living in a rather unpredictable world. We're seeing a resurgence of nation-state interests, especially regionally. we're seeing an assertion of national control over natural resources and commodities. Look at the difficulty a company like BP is having in its relations with the US government, with the Russian government. Global extraction companies are not, as it were, existing in very happy circumstance at the moment. There's a definite decline in international cooperation, perhaps at the very moment when we would need or expect more on difficult issues that, as it were, have to have an international response to hold them or progress them forward, like, for example, the environment, rising food prices, energy security. So that is, let's say, the current contemporary context. So let's move on now to the intelligence priorities and the way they may be shifting and changing. And I'm conscious that I'm not going to speak for more than half an hour, so I'm going to hurry through this to leave time for questions. Okay, counterterrorism, of course, is still very important. And we have to continue to watch and monitor Al-Qaeda, and I mean by Al-Qaeda whatever its central organization still is, its surrogates and its franchises. And we have to observe it particularly closely in Pakistan, in the Maghreb, in Yemen, in Europe, and of course in the UK. And I think at the moment Al-Qaeda is facing, and this is speculative, a crisis of its credibility. There's a pressing need for it to pull off something spectacular following bin Laden's death. And it has to do this outside and beyond Pakistan. Pakistan doesn't really count. So clearly there is the high risk of a spectacular, because terrorist organizations that cannot commit terrorist acts begin to lose their identity and lose their credibility. And that hasn't gone away. However, I'm beginning to think that the Arab Awakening, the Arab Spring, whatever we like to call it, is a truly significant event judged against the future of Al-Qaeda. What we have, to an extent unexpectedly and suddenly, is a different narrative present on the Arab street. A narrative which is complete anathema to Al-Qaeda. It is secular. It is democratic. It is about political participation. And it may be that Al-Qaeda, to my surprise, because I expected this to be a more durable problem, is already past its zenith and is on the downward slope. It may be. And of course, it's essential to track, and now I've mentioned counterterrorism, still important, still resource hungry, but it's essential to track politically what's happening in Egypt, Libya, Syria, Jordan, Yemen, and importantly, in Saudi Arabia too. To what extent is the reform initiative susceptible to being hijacked by Islamists? To what extent may these initiatives go astray and perhaps reinforce Al-Qaeda's brand? I don't believe they will personally, but obviously this is something that needs careful monitoring. So perhaps it's time to start reducing our counter-terrorist resources and looking more at the political issues that are causing such upheaval in the Middle East. And it might be worth interjecting at this point my strong belief, which has certainly increased since I retired, in the whole issue of proportionality. It's very easy to become disproportionate when one looks at issues like terrorism. What is, you know, the actual threat, the actual danger? Of course, for the government, that can be potent, but latent, but something that has to be taken account of. But if you start pushing all your resources into counterterrorism, perhaps, as it were, you're doing just what the terrorist wants, you're being distracted from other issues. And I suppose the question I'm raising here is, are we on the cusp of a very significant change and shift away from counter-terrorism being so predominant? The third area, which of course still remains vitally important, is Iran's nuclear capability. This must still remain a high intelligence priority. It's probably the most destabilizing issue in the Middle East. When will Iran have a deliverable nuclear weapon? How will Iran's internal politics influence its policy with regard to it becoming a nuclear weapons state? And of course, alongside Iran, there lies the whole issue of the continued proliferation of unconventional weapons technologies, particularly nuclear proliferation. Are there other Middle Eastern countries that aspire to become nuclear as a counter to Iran? For example, is there still any thought in Saudi Arabia's mind that it should acquire a nuclear capability over time? And of course, there are our concerns about North Korea, about Pakistan. And in Pakistan's case, the stability of the state, the safety of its nuclear arsenal, are issues which require close intelligence attention. Now, all of these issues are all familiar to you. They have a global signature in terms of how you might pursue them. And they're very much issues which have characterized the post-Cold War situation, especially since 9/11. There's nothing much surprising about that. And then, of course, we have what I would describe as the two legacy issues from this decade, the future of Afghanistan and the future of Iraq. And there's still a pressing need for both tactical and strategic intelligence. Will the Taliban negotiate? What, you know, is the future attitude and capability of the Afghan government? And then within Iran, the whole question of the Sunni-Shia divide, the relationship between the Iraqi government and Iran. And all of that is going to require close intelligence attention. But let me also say, much of this, in my opinion, can also be covered by effective diplomacy. And I think one of the things, and I'm conscious that there are two former foreign secretaries in the room, one of the things which is a great shame is the way that the area expertise of the Foreign Office has run down over time. When I first joined SIS, there was phenomenal geographic, linguistic and political expertise in the Foreign Office. Unfortunately, for reasons that we all understand, this has slipped away. But it's no good in the medium term thinking that intelligence expertise, which is strong in certain areas, can replace the role of the Foreign Office. And I would like to see the current government paying close attention to rebuilding that area expertise, which was always so strong. This certainly could take some pressure off our intelligence services. So beyond these issues, I've already mentioned the resurgence of the nation state. And to illustrate that, I think one looks at the problems that are characterized by Russia and China. To what extent should they be intelligence targets? In an ideal world, their national decision-making processes should be more transparent than they are. Especially in China, in practice, they are hidden from our view. And I think there's an awful lot of naive thinking about relations with China. We need insights into how they develop their policies. We need insights into the influence of the PLA, the People's Liberation Army. We need insights into the relationship between the party leadership and the military leadership. China is still a communist country, even if economically we don't think of it as a communist state. And loss of control is what the Chinese leadership most fears. And we need to be alert to their thinking as to how they may lose control. And in my view, at some point in the next decade, there will be, let's say, a crisis of leadership politically in China. So, yes, they're a necessary economic partner, but a problematic one as well. So I hope that there are more resources being devoted to this problem looking ahead. Russia, too, remains a difficult partner for Europe, prepared to use its energy resources aggressively, very possessive about its own sphere of influence, and still, somewhat to everyone's surprise, an aggressive intelligence power. In my view, Russia should be a natural partner for Europe if it could escape its neurosis about its own identity and role. And interestingly, when I was chief and went to Moscow a fair amount, I got beaten over the head by my Russian colleagues, if one can call them that at the time, who said, why won't the US treat us as more serious interlocutors? Try and persuade them to take us more seriously. I think that's still a significant problem, although maybe with the Obama administration there have been some attempts to mend it. So Russia, I think, still requires some presence in our requirements. To an extent, I think this is unfortunate. They would be very effective allies on a number of issues. So what are the other issues, if one takes now a broader view of national security, that we might include in the resources? And I'm not going to say anything about, let's say, minor short-term crises that impact lightly on the UK's core interests, but they may on occasion stir Westminster and the media and may play into our concerns, let's say, about an ethical foreign policy. For example, Zimbabwe, southern Sudan, you can all name a number of issues. And of course, it's important that the intelligence community maintains, let's say, a sort of flying squad that can, as it were, be deployed in the short term to look at issues like that when the need arises. But let me make some other suggestions. Should environmental issues be expressed in our intelligence priorities? Should they be there amongst the requirements? Probably there is a role for intelligence collection in certain areas, like the illegal trafficking of toxic waste, which is a big deal, cheating on international agreements, maybe in certain areas and issues on unfriendly governments negotiating positions. I think all of these issues lend themselves to being included in our intelligence priorities. So that's the first. The second, I think, is looking more closely with intelligence resources at the whole question of cyber aggression. Both deniable cyber activity and what I describe as unattributed cyber activity. I think it's important that we increase our understanding in this area, and probably intelligence is the only way of getting to the core of what's going on. My own view is that this is an issue similar, let's say, to the issue of chemical and biological weapons in the 80s and the 90s, and that eventually we will be into some sort of international disarmament agreement or negotiations to try to, as it were, regulate the whole question of cyber activity. But until that time, it does require intelligence treatment. The next area, and this brings me on to the whole question of economic well-being, which I am aware is highly controversial. To what extent should intelligence resources be used on issues of, let's say, financial security, on issues of energy security? And the ISC, I know, has struggled with this in the past and tried to work out some guidelines. But I think what I would say that my views about this have certainly changed since the banking crisis of 2008. And central bankers are very good at running their own contacts without calling those intelligence operations. And that's what they should do. They should be extremely well informed. But they may, I think, need help from time to time. Being forewarned is being forearmed. And we should not be squeamish about using all of the means at our disposal to protect ourselves economically in times of crisis. And finally, I think I would add two other issues. The first is the question of migration. If you look at the demographics, let's say, of Africa and the speed of growth of countries like Uganda and Tanzania, and the likely pressure that is going to be exerted on Europe for these massively increased populations to surge northwards, I think the border agency needs all the help it can get. And particularly in the area of looking at the criminal organizations that will traffic any commodity where they can make high profit and where the penalties are low, relatively, if they're caught. And in fact, one of the things that had happened when I was still in my previous job is that the growth of counterterrorism displaced the work that the agencies was doing to help law enforcement in looking at serious organized crime on an international basis. I think there's a strong argument for, as it were, reviving some of that activity and maybe thinking carefully about the relationship between the new National Crime Agency and the intelligence and security community. So I hope I've scoped there a number of issues. Let me just make one or two further points which I think are important. I think in our minds we always need to draw a distinction between mysteries and secrets. I think some of you heard me say this before. Essentially, intelligence services are out to find out secrets, or let's say pre-secrets if they're not exactly secrets. Mysteries, okay, they can be elucidated by good analysts and by informed speculation, but basically intelligence services are looking for hard, hidden facts. The second thing I would emphasize is I think that human sources are still at the core of our effort in most of these areas. That means scarce resources, relatively high risk. These assets should not be used lightly. And I think one of the things I've discovered since I retired is that good exploitation of open sources can tell you in this day and age an amazing amount. And the UK has done a certain amount to develop its open source investigative capability. I could probably do more in that direction. I would also put forward the thesis that a smaller defence budget should imply a slightly larger intelligence budget. And I think I'm talking about a very fractional transfer from one to the other, and to an extent that's happened, but I wonder whether it's happened enough. And there is a particular thing I wanted to mention, is that post 9/11, my service was given a dispensation to keep on and re-employ all the experienced people that it had at its disposal. And this was massively important. What I think people forget about the intelligence services is that it is a profession. It takes years to develop good case officer skills. And that has always been why the UK has been cutting edge and respected internationally in the area that we're talking about. I'm disappointed, I think, to see evidence of the fact that an awful lot of those experienced people are now leaving government service and no apparent attempt is being made to hold on to them. This is a relatively small group of people with unique skills, and the government should let go of them lightly. Well, they should let go of them without carefully considering the implications of what they're doing. And I think they could well make efforts, although every department has to offer up its cuts, to try to make sure that this rather extraordinary core of expertise is not diluted and lost. And on that point, I think I'll hand over to you for questions.